From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. Thank you for listening. Thank you for encouraging us. Thank you for sending financial support to us. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Jewish feast of Passover began at sundown on Friday and continues until April 30th. April 24th is the Orthodox Christian observance of Palm Sunday. Friday brings the Baha'i ninth day of Ritvan and the Orthodox Christian Holy Friday. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, after an aide to GOP presidential contender Donald Trump accused the Ted Cruz campaign of, quote, Gestapo tactics earlier this month, a Cruz surrogate has now used the phrase Gestapo tactics to describe the Trump campaign. When are we going to get over this language? But the media focus more on the supposedly nasty tone of the Clinton-Sanders race. Campaign quote of the week comes from New York Congressman Peter King, a Republican, who said on MSNBC's Morning Joe, quote, I hate Ted Cruz, and I think I will take cyanide if he ever got the nomination. Last month, King said he might have to get out of politics if Donald Trump was the nominee. Rock, meet, hard place. For the first time, a court has found a violation of Title IX in a school's banning a transgender student from using the bathroom that conforms with his gender identity. While this was a Virginia case, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals also has jurisdiction over North Carolina, where the issue is bound to end up in a lawsuit. And in Tennessee, the state legislator who's been pushing that state's anti-LGBT bathroom bill has pulled the proposed legislation for further study of the issue. Despite many conservatives refusing to consider President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court and claiming things are just fine until a Republican occupies the White House, the 8-member court has found itself in another tie, 4-4. It's the third such instance since the sudden death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Now, here's what's coming up on State of Belief Radio.
Donald Trump is back at it, launching insults at Ted Cruz.
If anyone in the media doubted the level of anger and acrimony between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, that vanished.
We're helpless to resist another Ted Cruz lookalike, only this one is a she.
There's a risk of it becoming just background noise. Month after month of political rhetoric and spin and supposedly expert analysis, what's actually important among recent events in the presidential election? I'll ask Greg LaBelle, a veteran of several national campaigns and our go-to expert on these matters.
It's a wonderful, wonderful holiday for our friends in the Jewish community, the Passover.
With the Jewish observance of Passover underway, we'll look at what the timeless teachings of that tradition can offer us in today's troubled world. I'm looking forward to having Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, president of CLOWL, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership, back on the show this week. But first,
she was born to parents who don't believe in the power of doctors to heal.
My mom's reaction was that I needed to be prayed over.
The issue is refusal of medical care, specifically for children, by parents whose faith instructs them to count on prayer alone for healing. Work to address the damage done has been going on for years. Judy Cross is board chair at Interfaith Alliance of Idaho. She's been deeply engaged with a statewide coalition to demand change. And Judy, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton. It's an honor to be here with you.
32 states offer protections for parents who make these kinds of decisions under the auspices of religious beliefs. Let's begin with you talking about the law as it is right now in Idaho and what needs to be done about it.
Well, in 1972, all the states enacted religious exemptions in criminal and civil statutes as a requirement for them to get federal funds. But that's no longer the need for that. Many states have repealed their so-called shield laws, but Idaho is one of six who still has exemption against manslaughter. Mm-hmm. This means that a parent cannot be investigated or charged with neglecting a child, even if that child dies or has serious permanent disabilities related to not getting any medical care. Our law is specifically written into the child protection statutes. Mm-hmm. In some areas of our state, we have a death rate of 10 times the child mortality rate of the rest of the state. And these areas coincide with areas where families are part of faith groups that believe that they should be doing healing by prayer alone and not allow any, I mean, they're adamant about not allowing any medical care to be provided.
Is that a pretty small group of religious traditions that do that, or are there multiple religious traditions involved in this?
It's a relatively small group of religious traditions. The followers of Christ are one group. There are some fundamentalist Latter-day Saints that do this. Christian Science as well, but they don't seem to be as extreme as some of these other groups.
Yeah.
And in Idaho, all you have to do is declare that it's your strongly held religious belief and not necessarily have to be part of a group.
So why is that law so entrenched in Idaho? What's the history of trying to change the religious protections for parents? What are the blockages that you're experiencing there?
We took on the challenge 3 years ago to try to get some change in the statutes. We've been working with other organizations, with the Protect Idaho Kids Foundation, with Janet Heimlich, with the Child Friendly Faith Project, with a number of individuals who have been affected by this in their childhood and in their family. Mm-hmm. And we have worked on bills to go to the legislature for 3 years in a row trying to get them through. We have several legislators who are really wishing to make this change, but a number who are afraid to push the issue because they say it's the parents' religious freedom to practice their religion in whatever way they wish, including denying medical care for their children.
There are many people who will say this is a matter of religious freedom. What's the best answer for people who say that?
You know, I believe that when religious freedom becomes a weapon, that it's no longer religious freedom. There have been two Supreme Court rulings over a number of years that have said it's okay for adults to martyr themselves, but it's not okay for them to martyr their children who have no say in this, who, even though they beg for care, are not allowed it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of the basis of this. Mm-hmm. We've worked with Senator Lee Hyder, who is the chair of the Senate Health and Welfare Committee in the Idaho legislature. And he actually was willing to carry the bill last year for us. He promised he would carry it this year. And we just had our legislative session from January through March and then just left to go home. But one of the things that he says is these families love their children just as much as you and I do ours, and it's their religious freedom to choose what care their children get. And we should not be limiting their religious freedom. It's a First Amendment right. And yet, overwhelmingly, the majority of people, clergy, religious groups are saying it is not okay when your religious beliefs causes such severe harm.
Mm-hmm.
we're averaging 3 to 4 children per year that are dying because of this.
Mm-hmm.
And since we've been working on the bill over the last 3 years, there have been almost 12 children that have died that we know of, from very, very preventable things, from injuries that were simple to be corrected. And the story, Mariah's story that you heard on Good Morning America, as well as today's show this week.
Mm-hmm.
Mariah is one of a family of 10 children, and she was born with a very, very small hole in her heart. Actually, it was a patent ductus arteriosus, which is just would take a very simple procedure, and many times it's only just medication. I mean, it's common. And she was denied that care until her 18th birthday. They diagnosed her with such severe illness that she's going to have a heart and double lung transplant in order to survive.
Mm-mm. What do you think the chances for success are in the near future?
We feel like we're really making some good progress. We have a campaign going called Let Them Live, and it's supported by all of our coalition. Bruce Wingate with the Protect Idaho Kids has been doing a whole lot of work and developing videos. So we're going to have some short video clips that we would like to get into the media between now and the next legislative session in January, telling the story of families, of children, telling the stories of physicians who have encountered these situations, telling the stories of clergy and their sense of how this is not appropriate from a religious philosophy standpoint. We have a physician who has treated some of these families, and his experience has been that many of the young families that really want to get care for their children are blocked by the elders, but they believe in being law-abiding citizens. So if the law was changed, it would take the burden off them when they are getting so desperate for care for the children. In Oregon, when the law was repealed since 2011, there have not been any deaths of children in that group. If we could just get the law changed, we would be saving not only children from dying, but also children from a whole lot of pain and suffering and illness and permanent disabilities. We're trying to raise money to get these videos out. We've been working with television stations, with newspapers, with investigative journalists, and doing town hall forums, and we're going to be traveling around the state. We have backing from the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Idaho chapter. They were co-sponsoring the bill this year. And I think we have a lot of momentum going now if we can just get the funds to get all of these PSAs out so that we get wider awareness across the state so that we can put more pressure on our legislators to do the right thing.
Judy, tell our listeners how they can get involved and how they can support this important work.
We're trying to raise about $9,000 before May 15th. Our email address is TIA of Idaho. That's for the Interfaith Alliance. So TIAOFIDAHO@gmail.com.
Judy Cross is board chair at Interfaith Alliance of Idaho. In coalition with a diverse group of partners, the alliance is working to increase protections for minors needing medical treatment but denied that treatment by parents on the grounds of religious convictions. Judy, I appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Wilton.
Despite the desperate efforts on the part of much of the mainstream media to generate endless headlines of conflict and drama, with the goal being continued ratings and revenue, it's inevitable that for many Americans, the endless political season is fast becoming just background noise. That's tragic, since the stakes are so high and the issues so real, but I have to confess that there are some evenings I just say to myself, I can't take it again tonight and turn on something else. For a look at what's been happening and whether we ought to be paying even more attention, I'm joined once again by Greg LaBelle, Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University and the veteran of several presidential campaigns. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Milton. It's good to be back.
How are you faring in the midst of all this stuff?
Well, you know, it's funny what you just said about wanting to turn it off, and it's sort of frightening to me to realize that I feel the same way as often as not. This has been just the strangest and most, in many ways, disconcerting presidential election cycle that I certainly can remember, and I've been through a few of them, as you know.
Yes. You know, it's been interesting, Greg, to watch some big names in the GOP distance themselves from this summer's convention. Jeb Bush, John McCain, among others, said they're not going to the convention. And this is a fascinating moment for the party, even as outsiders like Donald Trump condemn the so-called party establishment. Some of the most establishment figures in the GOP seem to be saying the convention process itself has been lost. What are your thoughts about all that?
There is probably no single better way to get a sense of just how confusing and disturbing this whole process is than what you're talking about. And it's not just the John McCain's of the world. I mean, the Speaker of the House put out a statement, I think, sometimes this week, urging Republican office holders to go to the convention. What a strange thing for the Speaker of the House to have to say, particularly for members of the Senate who are up for election. Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire is talking about not going. I think Kirk is talking about not going. So it's a real problem. Nobody knows not only what's going to happen at the convention, but who's going to control it, what the process is going to be like, and certainly the question of floor fights and so on and so forth is something that hasn't been this real in a very long time, probably since 1976.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion regarding the way Ted Cruz has been able to gain delegates by understanding the process in different states, while Donald Trump shouts about being cheated. What does this tell us, Greg, about each candidate and as well about the process itself?
Well, it's interesting that after the New York primary the other night, Donald Trump was not out there talking about how unfair the process is because he did very well on Tuesday night. But this is indicative of sort of where we are. And I think we see this on both sides right now. These rules were in place long before these folks actually got engaged and started the process. This is the way it's done. And I think that what we see on the Republican side is the fact that the Cruz organization is, in fact, a formidable organization. They have been playing by the rules with regard to these delegates and doing exactly what they need to do to win delegates. I think that Trump thought that he could win this thing on the force of his personality early on, and never occurred to him that he was going to have these kinds of issues. And clearly it didn't occur to his relatively inexperienced senior staff that he had pulled around him. Now all of a sudden we see Trump sort of surrounding himself with the Paul Manafort's of the world who understand the process and are able to deal with it. So the other thing that's disturbing, I think, is the incredible lack of understanding on the part of the American people, of voters, about how this works. Mm-hmm. Complaints about how everyone should have an opportunity to vote in the primaries and so on and so forth. Well, that's actually not true. This is a party function. This is not a general electional sort of operation. And there are rules to these things. And to be complaining about the rules at this point is a little childish, as far as I'm concerned.
And all the noise of sensationalistic campaign coverage, what's going on in the Republican Party that really bothers you in terms of the whole health of our democracy?
Well, I think that we can talk about from the Republican side, and I think to some extent it may be becoming true on the Democratic side, which is unfortunate. One of the things that we have seen through most of this process is the focus on personality and name-calling on the Republican side, which does nobody any good. And on the other side, we have seen up until recently, I think, a relatively issue-based debate. I think that has changed somewhat in the last few weeks, which is unfortunate. But part of this, obviously, is the question of how this thing comes about. What are the mechanics of this thing, and how the candidates manage to position themselves to win the nomination. But What happens afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
Two of these folks are going to be presented to the American people as nominees for president. How much damage gets done to that person between now and then is an important question. And I think the bigger question is how much damage is done to the democratic process as we look at if, in fact, the numbers hold and Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton end up as nominees. This will be the first time in the history of polling where we have two major party nominees who are, as we say, underwater in terms of public perception.
Mm-hmm.
Their negatives in both cases are higher than their positives. And this is absolutely unheard of. What does this say for governing after the election in November? I don't know.
Well, let me ask you one other question on the GOP campaign. Are there things the media simply aren't paying attention to in the GOP campaign that they surely should be covering?
Oh, sure. I think, first of all, for the lack of serious discussion of some of the issues that we're facing, that has been almost entirely ignored by the media, simply because of the presence of this larger-than-life character, Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
He has managed to stage-manage this process pretty much from the beginning, and this has been much more about sensationalism, quotability, those kinds of things, and rarely has it gotten down, I think, to serious discussion of issues. And that really continues. We keep waiting for Donald Trump to begin to act presidential, as he keeps saying he's capable of doing, but it just doesn't happen. So the media bears a great deal of responsibility, I think, for how they're covering this and what we're hearing. And I think that's what you and I and many other people are just disgusted about and mm-hmm. makes it so difficult for us to really pay attention to the news coverage of these things.
Well, Greg, let's shift now to the Democratic campaigns. Do you think the media portrayal of the gloves are off combat between Clinton and Sanders is accurate?
Well, if we look back over the past year, we remember that, you know, when this whole thing started, we thought that basically we were going to have a very boring campaign on the Democratic side. Basically, it was going to be a coronation of Hillary Clinton, and it turns out to have been anything but that. I think that's true on one side and not on the other. I think that the Clinton campaign is at the point now where they need desperately to turn to the general election. And you heard that in mm-hmm. Clinton's speech after winning the New York primary. She's been focusing more and more on Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee on the Republican side. For the Sanders people, it's a very different situation, though, because they need to keep that sense of urgency alive in order to keep their constituency alive and focusing on this race. You know, this is roughly the point at which Hillary Clinton went to her staff 8 years ago and said, let's face it, Barack Obama is going to be the nominee. We need to turn away from direct attacks on Obama and begin to figure out how to sort of put this together so that we don't endanger Barack Obama as a candidate in the general election.
Mm-hmm.
There's no indication yet that that's happening on the part of the Sanders campaign. There seems to be still a real effort to continue, I think, a heightened level of attacks on the Clinton candidacy without regard to what happens after the nomination is in place.
Are there aspects of the race for the Democratic nomination that are getting lost in the coverage that we're seeing, that the media simply are not focusing on?
I think that the media has begun to look a little bit more closely at the two candidates and their positions, and there have been some good stories written of late that are beginning to address some of that. I think we sort of have the opposite challenge here on the Democratic side in that there has been a lot of talk about issues over the course of the month. But I think what the media often does in its search for the horse race kind of stories, they tend to avoid the stories about actually the similarities that exist, how close the candidates are on most of these issues. And I think you can say that across the board. I can't think of a single issue that philosophically that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders disagree on. It's sort of what we do and how we get there. And this is not unusual. This was the same situation again back to 2008 between Clinton and Obama in this process. But there's little attention to that because the horse race stories are much more interesting and much more fun to write.
Mm.
I think the media is so happy to have the fact that Sanders did so well because they got all these stories to write that they wouldn't have had an opportunity to write if he had not caught on the way he did. So that's that distinction, I think, on the Democratic side.
I'm curious, Greg. We've spent a lot of time this campaign cycle bemoaning how none of the old rules apply anymore. There's been very real damage done, and I think that's hard to deny, but is there anything positive that's come out of the changes that we've seen? Is there a benefit to the weakening of the party system, of outsider candidacies, and all the rest of it?
Here's what I think the light at the end of the tunnel might be. I think what we're seeing now is an appalling lack of understanding of how the process works. And, you know, we saw this, we go back to the fight over Obamacare in the House and Senate several years ago. And I think one of the things we realized then is as the legislative process was playing out and much more under a microscope than it used to be, one thing that became clear, I think, was that a vast majority of the American people have no understanding of how the legislative process works. And I think we're now seeing the same thing with regard to the electoral process. This is not to say that things might need to be changed, but people wanting to change the rules halfway or two-thirds of the way through the process don't make any sense. What I hope is that what we end up with is that the spotlight on the process helps over time, and I'm talking probably the next 3 years or so, to engage people in a discussion about exactly how this process should work, and that maybe the result of this awareness that people really are not clear on what this process is or what it's intended to do, how it works, may lead to a serious reconsideration of how we do things and of civic education. I happen to be a big proponent of improving our civic education in this country, both in the schools and outside the schools, because I think we are abysmally ignorant of how the process works and is supposed to work.
Yeah. One of the concerns I always have about these election cycles is what happens the day after the election, and what condition is our nation in at that point? And I think you are waving the red flag saying, let's don't so destroy this cooperation that's needed in a democracy just to win an election.
Yeah, and I think that we are closer to that unfortunate situation than we've been in a very, very, very long time. Again, we remember how contentious the battle on the Democratic side for the nomination was in 2008, but how quickly the two candidates came together and eventually brought their folks together to unite around the nominee. I think that it's going to be a real challenge on the Republican side, because you have some serious differences, more than I've seen in a very long time, between various segments of the Republican Party. And I think we have folks at the top of that debate right now who are not acting probably in the best interest of what happens to the country after the nominations and the general election. That's what really kind of frightens me.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University, where he is the director of the Semester in Washington Politics Program and the Native American Political Leadership Program. A veteran of several presidential campaigns over the years, Greg has also served in several leadership roles at Interfaith Alliance. As always, friend, it's good to hear your voice, good to learn from your wisdom, and thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's great to talk with you as well, Welton. Thanks.
The Jewish observance of Passover began at sundown Friday night. Along with other major Jewish holidays, Passover offers lessons beyond Judaism and even beyond religion. I'm very happy to be joined now by Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. Brad, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's an honor and a joy to be with you.
I certainly live where there is not a strong Jewish presence, and I'm around a lot of Christians of different stripes, and often I will hear someone in the Christian community say, Passover, I thought Passover occurred at the same time Easter occurs, and so what are you doing celebrating Passover now?
Aren't we a little late?
So I thought it might be helpful for you just to talk about why Passover is where it is this time. course.
I would be happy to. Yes, Passover is a little late this year, and that is an expression you'll even hear in the Jewish community, where it's clearly not pegged to Easter. What happens is that the biblical calendar is a lunar calendar. The lunar year comes up about 12 days short of the solar year being the one that the Christian calendar is pegged to, the American calendar is pegged to, most of the secular world globally is pegged to. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go with a strictly lunar calendar, the holidays start to migrate because they are those 12 days short. So a holiday that was in April one year is in June the next year, is in August the next year, and in fact, the large religion that does still work with a strictly lunar calendar is the Muslim tradition, and that is why people say, wait a second, Ramadan, the month of fasting that a lot of people know because they'll have friends or neighbors who they see are, you know, eating only after sundown and then stopping at sunrise the following morning. They say, well, didn't you do that a different time last year? Hmm. And the answer is yes, because it's a strictly lunar calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Easter will appear in a very rigid kind of time frame because it's strictly solar. The Jewish calendar, starting around the time or a little bit before the time of Jesus, was a mixture of called a lunisolar calendar. It mixes the lunar and the solar, adding an extra month seven times every 19 years. So if there's a 19-year cycle, seven times in that 19-year cycle, an extra month is added. And that month tries to keep the holidays more or less in the same season.
Hmm.
Now, why do we do all that? Because all of the ancient Jewish holidays have both an agricultural element and a social historical element.
Mm-hmm.
Passover was not only the story of redemption from Egypt and the journey into freedom, that's the historical moment, it is also the spring holiday, the holiday of rebirth and renewal as things are beginning to grow. So what happens is this happens to be a year when one of those extra months got dropped in, and Passover is a little bit later. Next year it'll spring back, no pun intended, start to drift again, and then another month will be added 2 years out.
And this is a good time to follow that by asking you to do a kind of Twitter length definition of how Judaism observes Passover.
Sure. The central piece of Passover is a kind of dinner party and conversation called the Seder, the first two nights of the eight-day-long festival. Families will gather at home, and they will tell the story of going from Egypt into freedom. Families will sit around, and the three central pieces of that observance, yes, there's all kinds of foods that people enjoy, and I get the when do we eat question, but the three central pieces are to tell the story in a way that each person feels, even to this day, that each of us ourselves is leaving Egypt, that each of us ourselves is being liberated. And in fact, the Hebrew word for Egypt, Mitzrayim, actually means a tight spot. So the first thing, the central observance of Passover, is gather with people you love, and tell the stories, both ancient and personal contemporary, of the tight spots you're in, and try and see yourself getting out of them. The three foods really around which that happens are the drinking of four cups of wine, or grape juice if you don't want liquor, and those cups are raised at the beginning of the meal to announce it's a sacred event, as we tell the story, because even though it's a story that starts in slavery, we trust it's going to end in happiness. At the grace after meals, so we know that having eaten the food, we are really satisfied and can celebrate it. And toward the conclusion of that Seder, in order to sing psalms to God of praise for the circumstances we're in. So that's the four cups of wine. There's the matzah, which is the thin, unleavened bread.
Mm-hmm.
There's no leavened bread for observant Jews for 8 days, no leavened anything. Because we had to leave in such haste from Egypt, there was no time to let the bread rise.
Mm.
And so we substitute matzah for bread on this holiday. And then the last piece are the bitter herbs. Because as beautiful as this story is, as much as we trust, we are going to be liberated. We have been liberated and will be yet again liberated. As much as we know we can eat that matzah because we are taking the journey into freedom, we also want to remember that things have been bitter and tragically remain bitter for certain people in the world, and that our freedom and celebration of it should never make us forget that there are other people who are still in the bitter herbs phase and are still suffering all kinds of forms of slavery all over the world.
There is such great relevance to the issues of the day in the Jewish religious calendar, and I'd like for you to just talk about the wisdom that is to be found in the Passover observance that is applicable to all people.
Sure, and I love that you appreciate it. And I would say that actually each of the world's great traditions, and I think sometimes people forget it from the outside and practitioners on the inside forget it, our traditions stick around because they are gifts from God to the world, to all people, and they all have things to teach us. For Passover, it seems to me it's pretty straightforward. Everyone has been at some time in their life or knows someone who has been in their own personal Egypt, in their own tight spot. And we know if we can gather together with people we love and tell the story of other people who got out of tight spots, we're probably helping to lift ourselves out of the tight spots we may find ourselves in today. Mm-hmm. And so that's the personal part of Passover that I think everyone needs and deserves. It is that liberation story, and if I can, without sounding disrespectful or glib, it is the story in some measure, or at least a part of Easter, that the dead really return to life. Don't ever give up on that. The dead return to life. The slave becomes free. The tightest story can become the most expansive. That's the personal. But it's also national and global. Slavery is a real problem in parts of the world today. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that metaphorically. Slavery, people who are bought and sold like shoes and cars and loaves of bread. And it doesn't affect 10 people or 100 people or 1,000 people. It affects between hundreds of thousands and maybe even millions of people. And so this is a moment to talk about what does it mean, as the Bible, most repeated phrase in the five books of Moses, remember that you were a slave in Egypt. What does it mean to remember that there are still people enslaved in the world, and that our freedom in celebration of it can never let us forget that we are not ourselves fully free until everyone is free.
You know, given how many people around the world today are threatened, wrapped up in fear, anxiety, and I'm pretty convinced that the people who talk about religious persecution in our society, and I'll talk about my own tradition, those people who say that Christianity is under persecution don't have any idea what they're talking about. There are people all over the world that, because of their religion, they are being persecuted. Connect those dots, please.
I know you're right about what you're talking about. That feeling of persecution is real, and it's ironic because it's real to people in very different settings. And so where I come at this from is I take people's feelings of persecution incredibly seriously, even if I don't necessarily agree with their analysis. So when someone in America says that they, as a Christian, feel they are under attack religiously, I feel it's my obligation to take that seriously. Even though I also might point out to them, since, and we'll just keep it in the frame of Christian persecution, you could go half a world away and people are being murdered because they're Christian.
Right, right.
You could go half a world away and people are spending their lives in prison for having a Bible that they're not supposed to have. That seems to me as very serious persecution. And what I would then say to the person here is, I get it. There are times even people in the majority feel under duress or even under persecution. because somehow in our pursuit of trying to honor minority needs, the majority feels, how did this get so backwards, and now we feel we have to apologize.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, not related to religion. Alexis de Tocqueville noted that when he came from France to America and talked about the danger of the tyranny of the majority, and then also said that the minority can also tyrannize because in the desire to help them, we forget the majority. So I get all that.
Mm-hmm.
I would simply say to those people who feel that way, let's make sure that in helping you feel less threatened, less tyrannized, less apologetic, less persecuted, we not persecute others. Rather than debate who's persecuted and who's not,
yeah.
I always point out there's very little hope in achieving your freedom by persecuting other people. It just doesn't work. So if you genuinely feel that your tradition is being persecuted, I promise, even if I don't agree, I will take that claim seriously and invite you who feel persecuted to commit not only to your own religious freedom, but to the religious freedom of others, and let us be free together.
Brad, how wonderful it is that you can take even people that I think are manipulating religious freedom for their own purposes, and you could see a sensitivity in that and bring an inclusivity to it with also a message that is challenging for all of us to be able to share the same rights.
Well, I'm going to tell you what part of it comes from, and I think it's a tribute to you, and this is not just giving a compliment back. I am an outsider to that Christian world that feels persecuted. My job as an outsider, especially when I'm annoyed with them, is not to wag my finger and shout. It's to practice greater compassion. You're an insider. And from the inside, your job is to raise that prophetic voice and say, my brothers and sisters, have you lost your mind? What is going on? You know, it's easy for me to be spiritually generous because guess what? At the end of the day, it's not my community.
Mm.
And I think this, and what that means is if every outsider would be more generous, and every insider, by the way, I don't care if this is on Christian, Jewish, Republican, Democrat,
mm-hmm.
if you're on the outside, be a little more generous. If you're on the inside, raise your voice. So I think it's exactly the way it should be. You should be triply annoyed and raising that voice. And I should be saying from the outside, you know, maybe I need to slow down and try and understand a little bit better.
Mm.
Typically, we get at the reverse. The outsiders critique, the insiders defend, and nothing gets changed. It ought to be that the insiders critique and the outsiders defend.
Thank you very much for that insight and those words. Brad, earlier this month, you posted a thoughtful response to the proliferation of divisive religious freedom laws in states across the country. I wonder if you'd just say just a little bit about that.
Sure, and it's related to what we're talking about. I actually am pretty modest about what are often called religious freedom restoration laws and things like that, because I do understand that people may have very different views from mine, or very different policies that they understand they're called by God to observe than I do. And I do want their needs respected. I believe with all my heart that protecting the religious needs of others, even when I find them objectionable, is a big piece of what religious freedom is about. My plea, and I would go further, my insistence with them, is that in pursuit of securing their own religious freedom, which I promise I will fight side by side with them, even as we disagree about what that means, is that they cannot fight to curtail the exact same thing for other people.
Mm. You know, I want to say to you, and it seems a little presumptuous, I want to bless you and the Jewish world as you observe Passover this year, and I want you to share, if you feel like it, with us, the blessing that you would give as one of the leaders in Judaism, the blessing you would give to some of us who are not in that community, but who are participants in what you're celebrating during Passover?
So first, Welton, I want to thank you. I'm very grateful for and take very seriously your blessing. You're a teacher and a leader who I have both great respect and affection for, and to receive your blessing is a very, very big thing for me. So thank you, personally. The blessing for the world on Passover, I won't invoke my image, I'll invoke the Bibles and the later rabbis. They imagined that the people who went free from Egypt were not only the Israelites, but other nations of the world also went free. And so the blessing is that as I proudly celebrate this 3,000-plus-year story of Jews going into freedom, I know I am obligated to fight for the freedom of others and hope and bless others that they should leave the Egypts, the tight spots they are in, and journey out into lives of freedom and prosperity, and then pay that forward by helping others do the same.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership in New York City. Rabbi Hirschfield was ranked 3 years in a row in Newsweek as one of America's 50 most influential rabbis. His book, You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism, is as relevant today as it was the day he finished writing it. Brad, as always, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's an honor, Welton. Thank you and all blessings to you and to all your listeners.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I hope this show has been as meaningful for you as it has for me. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or persons. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archives, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown up around State of Belief Radio, we're really proud of. That community is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. We're still standing right there, dodging what's coming at us. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.